for Lickin' On Lending.
Welcome, everybody. Good to have you with us.
Welcome to Lickin' On Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news, all related to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Transformational Mortgage Solutions. Now, here's your host of Lickin' On Lending, David Lickin.
Let's begin.
So good to have you all with us. It's Monday, May 6th. It is, without question, probably one of the more interesting podcasts we've got coming up. And they seemed like last week was interesting. This week is going to be more. Again, that is because this podcast is created by mortgage professionals. It is for mortgage professionals. And we're so grateful to have you as our listener. Again, our commitment is to bring you timely information in an audio format. And you can listen to it anytime, anywhere. We're doing more and more video. We're starting to include more video in some of the podcasts. So you'll see that show up in social media, and you'll see some reels showing up out of it. But there's so much we're going to be doing today. I can't wait to share out to the industry what we're talking about today. I'm so grateful to Adam DeSantis, Les Parker, Matt Graham, David Kittle, Alice Alvey, Alan Pollack, Bill Corbett, Mark Helm, all of which are here today joining us to make this podcast so impactful and so popular. It really has become crazy popular. Thank you so much. Byte Software, I want to say thank you to them, one of our lead sponsors. Byte Software has got probably one of the most flexible solutions in the LOS world out there, and one of the most flexible when it comes to workflow automation and the way you could deploy it. You don't need to have this big in-house team to do it or outside consultants working with you. Byte just gives you total control over the whole loan process. It's so affordable. The best part I like is it's affordable and they don't lock you into long-term contracts because, you know, it's nothing worse than a contract. If my deal is, if we like a relationship, all my contracts and consulting are done month to month. If I'm not adding value at any given month, anyone I'm working with can terminate the relationship. And that's, I'm going to be putting that out there. We should be doing that. I know the commitment to software world is a little bit different than a consulting relationship, but I got to tell you, that's what I like about Byte. They're really trying to align their interests with their customers' interests. So also Finastra has the same approach to it. Listen to the upcoming podcast we released May 1st, this last week, with Colin Gazinski, talking about trends among lenders in today's current market. And we talk a lot about the regulated world, banks and credit unions. Also, Lender Homepage is an all-in-one AI-powered platform that provides seamless front-end solution to the mortgage lending business. Check out the interview that we did with Rocky and Quay back in December 12th. Again, it talks about how you can use your mortgage tech to maximize your production in 2024. There's a lot of great suggestions in that, and we're all looking for solutions to increase production in this market, which seems to be just ever being challenged on that front. Also, another company that we are so excited to be partnered with and have as a sponsor is Truv, T-R-U-V, an income and employment verification, a service that allows you to get full leading coverage from that up to supports up to 90% of the entire U.S. workforce. The best part about that product is it saves you money over the market leader, 80% more affordable than the market leader out there. Check out the interview we did with Richard Greiser talking about new technology, new ways to cut costs. It was released on November 29th. Also, Angel AI. So thrilled to have Pavan and the whole team at Angel AI out there. It is a complete new paradigm. They're approaching the lending business in a completely new way. We're going to be getting Pavan back on here on the podcast to talk about it. We've featured him a couple times already. Listen to the podcast we've released with Pavan and Angel AI. When you're in their website, put in Angel AI and listen to everything what Pavan is saying. It's just revolutionary how the world of technology is changing, and Angel AI is leading it. Also, we're thrilled to have Candid. It's a CRM. Check it out. As well as the Mortgage Bankers Association of America. Thrilled to have their sponsorship, along with Lenders One and the Mortgage Collaborative. These two co-ops are so important to have in your game and helping you navigate these very complex, challenging times. Also, Mobility MMI and Modex is just provides you business intelligence that I recommend you use and consider if you're not already using it. Just talked to Dale Larson of Modex this last week. We're going to be featuring them in an upcoming podcast. I love the tools we have available to us. Gosh, when I own a mortgage company, wish we could have had the tools like this. It's just business intelligence on steroids. Also, check out KnowledgeCoop, a learning management system. Grateful to have their sponsorship. Last Wednesday, again, we released the interview with Colin Gazinski of Finastra. Check that out. Then upcoming episodes we've got coming out this week is this is a must listen to is the one releasing tomorrow with Mike Fratantoni of the MBA. And it's his mortgage market outlook. You'll be going to be talking about some of that today. But you'll want to listen to the entire interview. This coming Friday, we'll be releasing an episode with Richard Harris of Trust Engine. And that's on the Lickin' on Leadership podcast, not the Lickin' on Lender, not Lickin' on Lending, Lickin' on Leadership. Check out that website, lickinonleadership.com. Let's get over to MBA's Mortgage Minute with Adam DeSantis. Adam, what do you have for us today?
Hi, I'm Adam DeSantis. This is the Mortgage Minute, the latest news from the Mortgage Bankers Association. Last week, Freddie Mac announced that it updated requirements for using attorney opinion title letters, or AOLs, expanding the types of mortgages that are eligible for delivery with an attorney opinion of title letter. The expansion includes most mortgages secured by a property located in all U.S. jurisdictions, which removes one of the largest impediments to the broader adoption of AOLs on the Freddie Mac side. Other mortgages in expansion include those secured by a unit in a condo project and those in areas with deed restrictions. These changes are a necessary precondition for the possible broader adoption of AOLs on Freddie Mac loans, but it does remain to be seen whether lenders will choose to use them or if consumers will be aware of the option. MBA continues to monitor developments in the title insurance space. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you, Adam DeSantis. Appreciate that. We'll talk a little bit more about this when we're bringing up some of the other topics in our analysis segment. We'll just get into that. Be sure to sign up for the secondary marketing conference that the MBA is putting out there. Also, that's coming up here real soon in New York. They've added some content this year that is, I'm going like, man, I wish I could be out there. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to go this year, but they've added some more content that's really timely. So if you haven't already registered, I encourage you to do so. And then, of course, sign up for the Mortgage Action Alliance app, where we can support the MBA's efforts on the Hill, as in with Congress and the Senate. Appreciate all that they do for us. Let's get over to Les Parker's TM Spotlight and a macro view of the markets. What kind of music parody does he have for us today?
TM Spotlight Soundbites is brought to you by PowerSeller, making hedging easy.
The data hustle, they're not good at all. Moves like a loser, they are mixed up, down, done.
Dripping oil, softening gold, and cooling copper lifted the short end's hope that the Fed will ease this year. Friday's jobs report helped. Additionally, the Fed's significant slowing of QT in June lowers liquidity risk and confirms that it understands the problems of restrictive policies, high-priced consumer debt, and elevated real rates. With the year-to-date 10-year yield range being 381 to 474, expect surprises to take the yield beyond 5 and below 3.5% this year. These views are mine. See the data's context at tmspotlight.com.
But Powell Bears fell in love with a criminal. And bad data love isn't rational, it's physical.
Okay. Oh, there's a lot we could comment on that. There's a lot in this. I do recommend that you get signed up for Les Parker's TM Spotlight. You can do so and get the paid version of his newsletter. You get it for free by putting in the word power for PowerSeller in the sign-up code. Again, a lot of information in this, and there's a lot of commentary I can't wait to get to. But before we do, I want to get to Matt Graham's segment. So let's listen to Matt Graham, the founder of and CEO of MBSLive.net, here with his market update. And then we're going to talk about all this as we get into all that's going on. Matt? What do you got for us today?
Hey, everybody. Matt Graham with the MBS Live Market Update. Last week was hotly anticipated for the bond market with a big schedule of events, including economic data, the Fed announcement, and Treasury's quarterly refunding estimate and announcement. Week started off with the latter. Treasury released an estimate for funding needs for the upcoming quarter, and that was generally well received. Not a huge surprise to the bond market, not a big reaction, but a modestly positive reaction that started the week off on a stronger note. Tuesday, opposite effect came from the employment cost index, which rose at 1.2% in the first quarter versus a forecast of 1.0. ECI is a report that we didn't pay too much attention to for most of the past decade, but have increasingly paid attention to in the past few years as Powell and other Fed speakers have mentioned its importance in policy considerations. With it coming in that much higher than expected, it's just another piece of evidence toward sticky inflation or persistent inflation along the same vein as the Q1 PCE data that came out the previous week. But it didn't do any irreversible damage to bonds. It just sort of reiterated a defensive position heading into Wednesday's Fed events. There was other data on Wednesday morning itself that it included the ADP jobs report and ISM manufacturing. None of those were bad for the bond market, and neither was the Treasury's official refunding announcement at 8:30 a.m. All in all, the setup for the afternoon's Fed announcement was fairly flat, but still near the higher yields of the past several months. The Fed announcement itself was very uneventful, or very expected, you could say. The Fed acknowledged recently higher inflation, and they also announced the start of QT tapering, quantitative tightening tapering. That means they are going to shrink the balance sheet at a slower pace and eventually not at all. Some people have confused this with QE, quantitative easing, because from a functional standpoint, it does indeed amount to new bond buying on any given month from the Fed, but it is not something that is expanding the balance sheet or providing new easing to the economy. It's net easing and is best viewed as something that is less restrictive than it was before. But more importantly, it was very, very, very well telegraphed and widely understood to be a function of the drawdown of the overnight reverse repo facility, which has been shrinking rapidly. The Fed has said repeatedly when that nears zero, they will start to taper QT in order to keep ample reserve balances and avoid a liquidity crunch like that seen in September 2019. So again, it's not QE. It is a slower pace of QT. Instead of only reinvesting the treasuries that exceed $60 billion a month, they'll now reinvest treasuries that exceed $25 billion a month in net proceeds. The market had been expecting $30 billion, so the extra five is perhaps worth a little bit of bond bullishness. But again, it is not new bond buying. It is just less balance sheet roll-off. MBS, incidentally, not affected. They weren't expected to be affected, and as such, they didn't have any major negative reaction to that in terms of spread versus treasuries. The rest of the Fed events were limited to Powell's press conference, and that was well received by the financial market for a few reasons. First, he essentially reiterated that the next move will be a cut and not a hike in all likelihood. Yes, inflation has been problematic in the first quarter, but they still think it's going to fall into line. They're not afraid to cut rates before the election, even if that means they'll be labeled as political by some onlookers. They think that they've been clear enough in their ifs and thens that when and if the economic data suggests that it's time to cut, then they will cut. Only other thing, Powell pushed back on the notion of stagflation, and the market seemed to react to that particular comment in the moment to some extent. But all in all, not a super volatile Fed day as far as Fed days go. And we wouldn't really expect that given that they're very data dependent and we are waiting on the most important data, which will be May 15th CPI. But before then, we had last Friday's jobs report. Weaker than expected, in a pretty straightforward way, the bond market was willing to react in a moderate fashion. And there was also some element of correction to the previously oversold levels heading into the Fed. So the weak jobs report sort of created a nice miniature version of a perfect storm that was kicked off by Wednesday's Fed announcement and helped the bond market correct from 10-year yields that were getting up near 4.7 all the way down into the 4.4s as of Friday afternoon. And now this morning, things are off to a decent start sideways and waiting for May 15th because there's not much economic data on the calendar this week, really just treasury auctions. And those are best seen as creating choppy sideways volatility, not new directionality. New directionality will be CPI May 15th in all likelihood. That's going to do it for this week. Back to you.
Appreciate you, Matt, very much. Check out Matt's product at mbslive.net. Again, market data on nanosecond updates. It's most up current, up to date. It's so affordable. I don't know how anyone in the industry can be in this business as dynamic as it is right now without that. Put in the codes LOL for Liquid on Lending when you're signing up, and you'll get an extended trial period without having to put in a credit card. Again, just put in your credit card, sign up for it. It's so affordable and it's necessary. Let's get over to our panelists, regulars. Mr. Kittle, Bill Corbett, Alice Alvey, Alan, I'm really looking forward. Mark Helm, love to get your thoughts on this. Let's get started with you, Bill. As you listen to this, I can't wait to get into the discussion that we were talking about. It relates about the MBA's comment. We'll save that till after we get over this. But Bill, let's start off with you, please.
So I think what we're seeing with the bouncing around is still a lot of the, let's call it the battle, if you will, between the Fed, who to me understands what the rules of the game are and how things need to play out, and the government, right? And I'll say Congress and the White House just can't figure out how to take their foot off of the gas pedal. And I saw something last week that just shocked me. So they were talking about the student debt cancellation cost between $870 billion and $1.4 trillion. That's more than is what's projected to be spent on all education appropriations through 2034. Yeah, and that reminded me of something. And I know it's been said by a lot of people, but I remember hearing it for years from my dad, you know, who was in the financial services industry. And he always felt when you had numbers that were in billions and trillions, that you should write out the number of zeros. Because when people see billion and trillion in words, it
doesn't resonate with the impact of it.
And so you could have the exact same article, and if you put the numbers there, you will get very different reactions from people than reading the words. We've got to stop spending money that we don't have.
We can do that when we go to vote this year. We can set an end to this, at least go somewhere. But everyone says, yeah, but do you know that Trump increased debt? It was the greatest debt increase we had was during the Trump administration. So everyone who's one side of the aisle or the other always has an argument to throw in. Mr. Kittle, I'd love to get your comments on this. You look at where we're headed, and I know you and I have, you have a strong opinion on it, as I do. Comments? Well,
I'll feed on top of what Bill said is exactly right. When you write it out, the other thing is if we've become a society of debit cards. So when we're spending our money, it's all done with a card. Look at the account. Yeah. It comes. If you physically pay the money like we used to, we wouldn't spend as much as we spend because we've lost all reality of actually having cash and coin and what it means. And that's a micro look at what Bill just said on the government spending. It's the same way. It's just nothing but words now, and we just keep borrowing more than we have, and it does have to stop. I think it's interesting in the commentary we just listened to, there was one thing in there that the Fed may lower this year, even if it's as political.
That leaped out at me too. Yeah,
I'm going, you got to be kidding me. And even though it's a benign number last week, rates are still up, inflation. I've had this discussion with a friend in the business who was on the opposite side of the aisle with me last week. And it's the same flow of information from him. And that was inflation's coming down, and it's not. The rate that's climbing is lower. I've said it over and over, but it's still going up. I don't know how they lower rates unless it is 100% political or something major happens in the next 4 months. And I don't see it.
No, it's going to be hard to not see any rate drop in as we get closer to the election as not being political. I think that is just Chairman Powell's not sure where he's thinking on that one. Alice, get your thoughts on this and get over then over to Mark and then Alan. Alice.
Yeah, a couple of quick things. I like how Matt's piece where he did choppy sideways and new directionally, right?
yeah,
choppy love sideways. The lines he puts in there. Really aligned with also what Les was saying in that we have a big range of where rates could be throughout the rest of the year. And there goes the same thing we've been saying week after week is, you can't count on a set drop. You really just have to go out and work the market the way it is today and help customers understand it will be volatile, but you as a mortgage originator are going to watch that volatility for them. Mm-hmm. But that's really, I think both their messages were saying the same thing. So I wanted to make sure our listeners tied those two together. And then I'm going to just chime in on the student loan thing. What does the federal government have to do to be involved in student loans in the first place? That's just my two cents.
Amen.
What are they? That, how does that topic even get to that level? I get it. There's some real rough stories out there, but it is when you look at what should the federal government be doing and spending money on, there's a longer list before that comes up.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. And then it's just a vote getting thing going out and appealing to that generation. If we could cash your debt, would you vote for me?
Right.
It's just so obvious. Buying a vote. Mark Helm, jump in on this discussion, please.
I'm on a pedestal right now, so I'm just going to lay it out there really quick.
Okay.
I've been a study at the
soapbox or a pedestal? Soapbox or a pedestal?
Well, a pedestal is a hell of a lot higher than a soapbox.
Okay. Let her fly. Okay.
I've been a student of history my whole life, and I really have stood back and watched what this country has developed to during my lifetime. Haven't been real pleased with a lot of it. Go back to the original Articles of Confederation, how we set up this country, and so much of what the federal government's doing now was meant for the states to do and was never meant for the federal government to do. And we went off and ventured down those roads and caused ourselves a bunch of problems. I read an article, and I'm going to try to find, and I'll find it and I'll circulate it. It shows the debt in this country per person compared to the debt, as best we can tell, in other countries per person. And we're like 50 times higher than anybody else in the world. We seem to think we got an unlimited piggy bank to pay things. We don't. And it drives me nuts every time I look at it, because we have turned into a socialistic welfare state where we feel like we got to take care of everybody. People don't have to work anymore. Hey, don't worry about it. The government will take care of you. Go sign up. Go to college. Get a student loan. Don't pay it back even though you're employed and got a good job, because the government will take care of it. That's the way we always go down that road, and we can't do that any longer. We just can't. If you look back at the Articles of Confederation and the way that this country was established, we were to create the independent sovereignty of states, but we were supposed to do things in an overload sense, which was like provide for the military to protect the states and protect our country and things like that. And so the things we should be spending money on, we have to fight tooth and nail to get money to spend on. The things that we don't necessarily want to spend money on, it keeps going. And whoever said it was political is exactly right. It's appease the masses, get their votes. That's what it's all about. That's what it's always been all about. I frankly am quite fed up with it. And if I'm one of those things, if I could pack my bags and go to another country, I might do it. But there's not really still any country better than the United States. We just need to fix the problem, because if we don't fix it, those zeros are going to kill us in the long term. And we're going to be in worse shape than any other country in the world at a point. And I'm just dramatically concerned. I know everybody on this phone call has pretty much the same feelings that I do. I'm sorry I had to say all that. I've been too long. I should have been briefer. I apologize.
No, that's all right. Alan, I've got somewhere I want to go with after this, but Alan wanted to give you an opportunity to add any commentary.
Not to get political, I think both sides of the aisle agree. We need term limits. And I feel like we're in this position in a lot of ways because of the strategy on how to buy votes and win elections. And we're the only ones that suffer in the end. And I think that if there are term limits and there are some significant changes, which you and I both know it's not going to happen today, we would see a different path to success for American people. Right now, we are stuck in everyone else's game, and we're just bystanders, and we're the ones that pay the price in the end.
I think that if there's any one good thing that's coming out of all of this, as bad as it has gotten, and everyone says, I thought this is a mortgage podcast, not a political podcast. If you look at where interest rates are at, and you look at how much we're spending, you cannot ignore the fact that it's a political game and where it's at. What's amazing, if there's any good thing that's come out of this, is the number of people that were staunch Democrats are looking at this and they're saying, enough is enough. I've got to vote differently this year. I'm leaving the party and I'm crossing the aisle, even though I disagree with them. And if there's any bright spot in all this chaos, craziness that's going on with this administration, it's causing people to wake up, take notice, and actually start voting based on principles. I don't think the buying a vote, it's only going to exacerbate the problem of them people leaving the Democratic Party and in droves, and I really see it happening. And again, try not to go political.
David, one thing I want to make everybody on this phone call realize, we get a lot of people criticize Texas, but we've got a senator who's one of the best constitutional law people in the country, and Ted Cruz. And the first thing he does at every session of Congress is introduce a bill for term limits. And the success he's had with that has been growing slightly, but not at the speed it needs to. The first session of every session of Congress, the first session, he introduces that bill. And it's not like it's in everybody's face to start the year off. So we just need to have this groundswell across the country to get the politicians to realize that we need that.
I was going to just add about how the connection between our industry, when you start looking at student loans being repaid, that's a related lending industry. And there have been plenty of times with money to bail people out of foreclosure. So to me, that's where I think this conversation, part of what started it was, if you're going to start forgiving loans that banks make in good faith to be repaid, that's what gets our passion up. That's the connection in one way here.
Yeah, what's really interesting about the student loan discussion is this came up in the Obama administration, and Fox Business asked me to come in and comment on it. And again, I always like reaching out to Doug Duncan when anytime I was going on. They said, you're going to be debating Dr. Leonard Bernstein, who was at that time Vice President, Biden's chief economist at the time when he was vice president. And so I came on, and I said, Doug, how do you argue this thing? I know it's wrong. And he says, ask them this question when you're on air with them. What is the most fundamental tenet of economic law, economic principle? It's property rights. And I said, so I was on debating him. He says, I said, so Dr. Bernstein, I understand what they're trying to do here, but how does this fit with the economic principle of property rights? Because paying off the debt is canceling the debt to all these bondholders that have bought all these bonds. You're messing with the ownership, the investment of all these people. You're canceling that. You're just wiping that out, is what you're saying? Or is the federal government going to pay that off? How are you planning on doing that? And it was one of those conversations where they said, that's a gotcha question, because it was. You cannot mess with this, as you're messing with one of the fundamental tenets of our economic principles, economics. So yes, Mr. Kittle.
So this is related. I know Bill and everybody on here will, but my year as chairman in 09, as everything melted down, the one thing we defeated as an industry, MBA, the industry, was bankruptcy cram down. And Dick Durbin and his groupies and wanted to take a strip or a tranche out of a security, go in, and if somebody invested, just to throw a number out, and $250,000 at 8%, he wanted to make that $200,000 at 6.5%. And destroy individual investment. And that would have annihilated any MBS market going forward at all. Nobody could trust it. We defeated that. It's the same thing. They always want to go in without ever going back and looking at it, individual loans, to say, did any of the borrowers commit fraud on these loans, misstate them? Of course they did. Was our industry culpable in everything that happened? Absolutely it was. But the two people that never get blamed in stuff like this is the borrower, the student, and the federal government, who give it away. Yeah. And it's the same scenario. We defeated it in 2009. And he's taken sidesteps around this by doing it with executive order, Biden is, by however he's doing it. And it's unconstitutional. Yeah.
Mark, you talked about socialism and how that has crept into us in such a big way. I think Margaret Thatcher said it so well. She says, socialism works until you run out of other people's money. And that's what we're talking about here. So great comment on that. So very good. We could go on, but we'll leave it at that. One thing that Bill and I want to talk briefly, Bill, about the adjusted MBA projections. We had the privilege of Bill and I interviewed Mike Fratantoni on Friday afternoon, and we released the new slides. The MBA, as you're going to be soon seeing, if they haven't already made it public, is they have reduced the projections for fundings this year down from $2.1 trillion to $1.815 trillion. So $1.85 trillion that they're projecting in fundings this year. That's down. But what the most significant one is the units. The units are at 4,576,000. That is now, Fannie Mae published last week, these are the lowest levels in 29 years. I saw a headline, was it 29 years or that it's been like this low. Maybe it was longer. I don't know. I'm trying to.
Looking at the chart, it's even longer.
Yeah. That's right. Look at the chart. It goes back. Yeah.
David, those numbers have to work because prices are higher and average loan amount is way up. The lending volume comes down and we're not doing first time home loans because you can't build them, units have to go down.
Yeah.
The pie is smaller. The numbers don't.
Yeah. What's just interesting is that at 2021, the number of units. So again, if we turn this discussion away from the dollar fundings, but we look at what the most meaningful as it relates to staffing and what we're our workloads and what we're dealing with, you look at units. In 2021, we are at 14,194,000 units. This year, it's going to be almost 9,000 and change units less. And when you look at that, and what's really interesting is this was on slide, is we've reduced overall peak to trough where we're at right now, staffing, overall mortgage industry layoffs that have happened. We're down 35%, but our volume is down substantially more than that. So we still have so much excess capacity in this. Interesting, loan originator, MLOs, mortgage loan originators, it's been a decline to 29%. But overall, the whole industry, peak to trough, 35%. We have just too much capacity. Interest rates and our volumes, even at these levels, we're still their lowest volumes, and we have to deal with the units. And that's, I've been not focusing on that as much as I need to, as we all need to. So we're dealing with that. We need to get, again, another round of, sadly, layoffs, get the staff reduction. Otherwise, we're going to be continuing to watch this industry spend itself, just like our federal government, spend itself into oblivion. There's an increased number of companies. I want to get your comments on this, Bill, because I know you got a thought on this, but the number of companies that are now looking at this latest projections and are ready to throw in the towel is going to be really interesting. We're hearing a lot of rumors right now about companies saying, that's it. We're going to pull our cash off the table. We're going to close down and maybe come back to play another day. But right now we're exiting out. And I think as sad as that is for those employees that will be impacted by that, it's probably the right thing to do for those that don't have a strategy moving forward. Bill?
Yeah, so as I said when we were talking to Mike, I first saw this slide going back in history in units back in October. And it's really bothered me ever since when I think about it, which don't worry, it's not all the time. But we did 2021 where the industry, everybody agreed, we couldn't get another loan through the system then. And yet that was rounded, that was 60% of the number of units that we did in 2003. That's just, to me, is mind-boggling. And I'll throw three things out there is what's driving it, right? There's one, is all the spending on tech that we've done worth it? But then it's the regulatory landscape has changed so much. And the other one that I think kind of flies under the radar is, has underwriting lost the risk-reward balance? If you go back to 2003, that's when 6, 7, 8 loans a day, somewhere in that range, was the standard for an underwriting. And now they don't help solve the staffing problem, but we need to understand all these components to figure out longer term what this industry looks like going forward, because all we do is keep driving the break-even level to ridiculous heights. And
again, so much of it is the complexity of the compliance us trying to be. And we know what happens if we don't have regulation in there. We saw the last housing crisis as a result of that. But the thing that was really interesting is we start talking about the cost of compliance or the regulatory impact on housing. David Kittle, you remember the interview you did at TMC with the head of the Home Builders Association? I'll never forget that interview when you had him on stage. It floored me. The minimum cost that goes into every home, minimum, is 30%. They add 30%. And in California, it's 50 to 60% of the property value. Like in San Diego is what he's quoting, is one of the most onerous places. So when you look at the cost of a home, that's 30 to 60% of it is regulatory to protect the consumer. Oh, really? It is just making it so far out of reach. Love your thoughts, David. I know you remember that interview very well.
You remember the interview. That's like everything else. It's just the added cost on this is going to be a little out there just a little bit, but the NBA report we got earlier, he mentioned the AOL. This is a micro thing, but the attorney letter now approved by Freddie Mac. It's one way to lower the cost for the borrower to getting in. The other one, which we said on here before, nobody wants to be the first penguin in the pond. It's LO comp. Sooner or later, if companies are going to close and it continues to squeeze in units, companies are going to have to reduce. Everybody's got to be in on this. You just can't keep laying off support staff and paying.
And we talked about that.
Right.
And we talked about that with Mike when we were interviewing him. And he asked us, he said, Dave, this is more your area. What do you think? And I said, it's going to continue to stay high as long as we have companies out there paying sign-on bonuses for anyone signing up for originators. We're still at a place where there's enough capital out there with some people that they're buying the production and they're buying mediocrity. In many cases, they're buying mediocrity. It's really interesting. So I don't see that change as much. I agree with you, David, as much as it needs to change. I don't see that changing until someone, the first penguin goes in the pool. And it's got to be one of the big guys because they're the ones that are right now exacerbating the problem. When we look at some of the rates out there paying the kind of sign-on bonuses that there are, others are paying the same sign-on bonuses to get people. And it's a loan and it ties them up. And then they exit out. And even if they exit out, they have to repay it. I got a phone call from one of the guys who I begged, please don't make this move. Don't make this move. He says, yeah, but look at how much they're paying me. I said, no, they're lending you. They're lending you this money. And it is a repayment. If you don't, but I could really use the money. That's like saying, I want to borrow money from the bank and I'm not going to pay it back. You're going to pay.
Yeah. So they're buying mediocrity is one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is, they're buying bodies in a seat under the belief and the bet that there's going to be another refi boom, right? Because that's their bench strength that says we're going to be able to get all these loans through the system. That's going to run out pretty quickly because you can't keep putting more and more people on the bench with the belief that there's going to be a refi boom.
I think the only way we get back to a refi boom is if we go into a recession. For rates to drop when people want to refinance. And that's because no other way to get there unless you're not going to stop spending.
I use my daughter as a case in point. She's closing on her first home. They end up locking in at 7.4%. She goes, Dad, I know we probably hit it at the high. And I said, yeah, you did. I think you hit it. At least based on what Parker says, we could see some pretty wild swings in interest rates this year. But she says, but we'll refinance. As soon as these comes back down, we'll refinance out of it. We can afford it at these levels. I'd rather be doing it. And David, I sent that around what you said last week, where you quoted that if you had waited for interest rates to go up, you would have waited 22 years before you bought a home, wouldn't it? That was crazy.
Yeah, wait for interest rates to come up.
Yeah. So, I mean, it goes what you all have been saying regularly. We all been saying on this podcast is get out and do business. We can refinance it later. Is there going to be another refinance? We don't know. But it's just really interesting. We could go on and on about this one, especially when it talks about LO comp, but we do have so much we want to move on and talk about. Mr. Kittle, anything you want to add as we move on into Alice's segment before we go there?
No, I probably said enough today already, so I'm good.
Oh, I love it. I love it, love it, love it, love it. There's some of the interviews you've done at TMC have been just really well. Excellent.
Thanks.
And so I appreciated that one that stuck with me. Alice Alvey, let's get over to you. Alice Alvey, who is Vice President of Partner Education and Training. And Union Home Mortgage is here with Legislative Update. That's good to have you here. Appreciate you.
Thank you. Hi, Dave. Hello, everyone. And Bill teed us up today very well ahead of the program. And we have memos that came out from both Fannie and Freddie under the direction of the Federal Housing Finance Agency that are going to start, you know, floating out for all of us, the first generation home buyer criteria. And so their memos and then their accompanying guides that went with it are very full of different initiatives. As a matter of fact, the MBA spotlight from today's program on the attorney opinion letters is a component of that in trying to reduce title costs. And as you guys have mentioned, we are not fans to jump on that bandwagon right away because I like my title insurance. I'm not sure I want to just go with an opinion letter. I think a lot of the industry has indicated is still thinking that through. But nonetheless, that gives them the ability to say they've done something. And so what they're doing now that doesn't have any impact on the market from what I can see is defining a first generation home buyer and asking the industry as an option to fill in a form to have people certify that they are not only a first-time home buyer, but a first-generation home buyer, which involves having their parents, defining a parent, and also having their parents provide their address. And that's all we would do. We would include a special feature code or IFI if you're a Freddie user, and make sure that the loan is identified as meeting the criteria and having filled in this form. There isn't a price advantage or a special new program for these as yet. Essentially, it looks like they're trying to collect data. And Bill, as you mentioned, how do you verify somebody's a first generation home buyer? So I'll let you jump in here and then we can talk more about it.
Yeah, thanks, Alice. So I'm not a very good poker player, right? The subject line in my email is bringing this up is liar loans are back. There's clearly something coming with this, and it just feels like it's going to be built on the back of something that really isn't going to be able to be supported and documented. Or if they come up with a way to do it, guess what it's going to do? It's going to add more documentation and increase the cost to originate. The other thing that I thought about is the response we're going to hear now is going to be, oh, well, we're just gathering data to make policy decisions in the future. Okay, I don't know. I always felt like to make decisions, you need good, accurate, verifiable data to build off of. This is just going to be assembling a pile of garbage for somebody to make an agenda-driven pronouncement off of down the road. And don't think for a second that this is not the nose of the Trojan horse.
Yeah.
There's a lot of directions this is going to go, and it just doesn't feel like it's going to be well thought out and risk vetted, et cetera.
Yeah, I liked what you said, liar loans are back, because it does really get us into the point of what are we going to have as facts behind this? And it's pretty interesting. Yeah, thanks so much for bringing this up. Mark, Alan, David, any comments you want to add to the first generation home buyer loan?
No, very well said by Alice and team here. Great conversation.
Good. Alice, what else do you have for us?
I think it's a worthwhile read. And Bill, what you described is something that a lot of people, I think, are wondering is what is really going to happen out of collecting optional data, and how good will the data actually be for anybody to come up with a reasonable conclusion on then what can you do with it? So I think more to come, but that was really the main thing I wanted to report on that aspect was the fact that the form is optional. The FAQs really come out and explain that, yeah, in the future, there could be documentation requirements, but we don't know any of it yet. So wait and see is really what it is. One last quick thing. VA did issue a circular on a new form for assumptions. Assumptions sit in the background in servicing.
I saw that.
Just want to make sure everybody saw this form. They do want it delivered to the vet borrower as soon as possible. I really like the form. We get calls from people who are veterans selling their home. The realtors said, oh, sell on an assumption and doesn't know the facts. Sorry, realtors. But this is very complicated for the veteran to understand that they won't get their entitlement back. And this disclosure, I think, puts a little bit more fear in that even most people are communicating to the customer up front. And VA, I think, did a good job on this one. So get it signed up front. Make sure your seller's understanding the consequences of not getting their entitlement reestablished. So there would not be a substitution of entitlement. So I know a lot of realtors do a great job, but the mortgage side is our expertise, and we're the ones who need to decide if an assumption is a good idea or not. So that's my 2 cents. Dave, back to you.
Thank you so much, Alice. Appreciate it so much. Check out all of Alice's comments. We post them out there on each one of our segments. We post out Bill's and Alice's and Alan's and Mark's. All the comments are published separately on our website as we're tracking the views on those and listens on those. But it's really solid. Thank you, Alice, for being there. Check out all of Alice's comments on our website. Let's get over to Alan Pollock, who's here with us, and an update on the tech update. Alan, good to have you here, friend.
Great to be here, David. So yeah, a couple interesting things.
Did you notice that one comment that Bill threw out there teed up a topic for you right away? He says, has all this technology really helped us? And I'd love to have you respond to that question.
That's a can of worms, because some technology is absolutely needed. The exact reason why I built a pricing engine back in 2000. But then I think that there's some technology solutions that have tried to do more than that they should. The jack of all trades and master at none. And so what's happened is there's this melting pot of solutions and there's overlap. And it's actually interesting because it's one of the things I'm going to mention today, but there's inconsistencies between integrations and data and tech, and people are buying more solutions than they need. And so tech is great, but it is also confusing. I won't say it's working against us yet, because I think that's a personal opinion. But very interesting you also bring that up, David, because there is a comment that I wrote down here. Basically, this is what lenders are saying. Are you an AI solution, or do you have functionality that uses AI? Stop branding yourself as an AI platform. And that's a comment that a lender sent to me last week, not due to the program here, but I wanted to bring it up. And it's very true. It's just like the press releases in our industry. Everyone's the best, the lead industry leading. And I get it from the vendor side. I've been a vendor for many years, and you want to catch the eye, get the attention, create excitement. But not everyone is AI. Just because you may have a text field that you can use AI to help doesn't mean you're an AI platform. So I think we need to be better as vendors. And we're going to talk about that in a moment. Hopefully I answered your question, David and Mark.
So awesome. Let's get into your update. Yes.
A couple cool things. One, I wanted to mention that Spotify. So a lot of us, used to be the days of the office, but when we're working and trying to get stuff done and not get distracted from emails, we use Spotify, YouTube Music, and these other things. They just came out with what they call AI playlists. It's going into beta, or it's in beta in the UK and Australia, but you can actually refine and create playlists off of nothing more than text prompts. So you can say, hey, I'd love to hear some jazz music that focuses heavy on the saxophone and has so-and-so sound to it. And it will create a playlist for you with exactly that. So coming soon to a app near you, Spotify's AI playlist sounds pretty cool. Those are the things, David, where AI truly is unique and can do such great things. All right. I want to get into fraud just for one quick second, but we've got more exciting things to talk about. There is a finance worker. He's at a multinational firm. Get this. He was tricked into paying $25 million to fraudsters. And this is extremely important, so pay attention. Using deep fake technology to pose as the company's chief financial officer, they sent this gentleman a video conference call. And in the conference call, they deep faked all the people that work at the company that they said to be on the call. And they requested for him to send the money ASAP, that they were all traveling, et cetera, et cetera. There's a big article on it. You can just Google 25 million to fraudsters. But anyways, deep fake is real. If you don't think it can happen to you, they can record your voice. They can record your video. As the election period starts to heat up in the next 6 months, it's going to become more and more, especially on social media, with people not really saying things that you see. But deep fakes are a really big thing. We don't want to see a world where we have deep fakes occurring and people are wiring their down payment money to somebody that they shouldn't be. So let's be very careful. Let's be on our toes and let's work with our borrowers and let's keep them in the know. By the way, same goes with vendor payments, right? Lenders pay a lot of money to vendors. They pay upfront money. They have guaranteed contracts. So this can happen anywhere. Now, with that being said, David, check this out. In California, and they're talking in Alice, I'm sure maybe this will be a great topic for you to touch on next week. 20 to 25% of residential lending, it happens in California. And what they're talking about is a bill to give consumers the right to opt out of automated underwriting tools. I don't even know where this would occur, that a loan officer would even tell a borrower you have the option, right? A borrower wants to be qualified quick. They want to get a commitment letter out. They want to know what they can afford. Could you imagine as a lender having to manually underwrite or go down an alternative path because the state created a regulation where borrowers can opt out of automated underwriting?
Yeah, we talked about that last week briefly, and it's one of those ones where it starts a process where we keep
saying, yeah.
Could it happen? Yes. Could it go nationwide? It's being floated in California, so we could be concerned.
Yep. And back to your question about technology, these are areas where technology is critical to the cost and the overhead and what it actually takes to move a loan through the process. Yeah. All right, David, here's another great item. So we had the Mortgage Innovators Conference going on this week. My good friend, Paul Gelati, with a couple other folks, put that together. It's their third annual. They're very excited. I think it kicks off today or tomorrow. So good luck to those folks. And there's a good lineup of speakers. So if you're headed out there or you're listening to this after, I'm hopeful for the results and the feedback of being a lot of great content about how to move our industry forward. All right, now, David, let's talk about Sue Woodard from Stratmore Group. So Sue posted an article on LinkedIn, and I reached out to her for permission to talk about this. So thank you, Sue. And we're also, David, you and I are coordinating to speak with her for a technology interview. But what she basically said, she put this great comment out there. She said, straight talk from a recent Stratmore Technology Group meeting. They said to the lenders, tell us your pain points. Without the vendor knowing or being here, what is it you wish vendors would say? And these are great ones. Listen to this. Quit telling me about your roadmap and be honest about the road you were on today. Just tell me what we can realistically expect. You ready for this one? Show me the real system, not vaporware. Then she gets into a few more. I won't read them all. We're going to save some for the conversation with Sue, but one or two other great ones are, help me better support what I have before you try to sell me something new. And this one's great. Oh, there's two more. I really got to bring both of these in. There's a bigger list. Fix existing problems before you tell me about new features. Help me help you. And then the last one I'll bring up today is, if you have to lay off employees, don't lay off the people who know the industry. So yeah, there's a lot of great feedback. Sue tees off a bunch of more topics, as well as if you're a technology provider, she has an article where she's talked about going to therapy, lenders and vendors. It's funny, back to the comment about, is technology hurting us or not? I think we all need to do a better job. I think we need more transparency and clarity in what we're paying for. Places like the Mortgage Collaborative, those are fantastic places to speak to vendors and be real and open. David Kittle, you probably have had some of these similar comments and points of feedback with your technology providers, but in the end, we need to work better together. We need to try and stop as a vendor doing everything and understand that lender needs to break their risk apart. They need different options on different types of channels or loans. It's not a one for all and all for one. And we need to work together as an industry, especially with the cost being higher. So I'll end on that positive note, David. We have awesome technology solutions. We have great vendors, great lenders. We just need to do better.
Yeah, a lot of room for improvement. I like that one. Could you just make what's there what you sold me last time?
And shout out to Sue for putting that together. We appreciate letting us use that.
Sue's a good friend. Sue's that's a good friend. Looking forward to seeing her at the Total Expert Conference later this next month. And so good. Appreciate it. Look forward to that interview with her. Mark, anything you have for us today on servicing front or any updates on GSEs that you have?
I'd like to add one thing that Alan talked about there that I've seen with a couple of technology vendors recently that's been really good. The people that are being serviced by technology vendors really don't think it through enough, because what I would do is just what these other companies have done and the technology guys applied based on the technology you're using and how much interface you need with the people. Set up a one or a month meeting every month or a meeting every quarter where you go over where you are and pluses and minuses, the problems you're having and all, because I think that's a big problem. The technology people always want to come to you and sell you something, but like fixing the things that are broken or making them better, et cetera, seem to fall through the cracks. So I think it's important on technology to set those meetings up. And if they don't want to set those meetings up, that tells you a little bit about your relationship with them. I'm just going to close on that because I've experienced that a lot in my career.
That's a great point, Mark. And I got to tell you, back in the industry, didn't have as many tech vendors in the early 2000s. When I was a tech vendor, it was like selling a Honda. We'd get on a phone call, give a short demo, because people didn't have some of these tech solutions. They would just sign the contract and we made it real simple to get out of contracts. Now you're making a big commitment. You're signing 3 and 5 year contracts. You're putting money up front. And you're being sold. You're doing that based on what they're selling you. And if they would just be more honest and upfront, you can make a much more financially just decision as a lender based on what you're spending your money on.
I agree 100%, buddy.
We could be talking about technology a lot. It's not a topic that's going to be going away like Hello Comp, but there's going to be a lot settling out. There's a lot of rumors running around this week right now as we wrap up this podcast. I tell you, quit listening to rumors. Focus on doing your business. That's the most important thing we do. If you're an originator and your company decides to close or gets sold, you're in good standing. Just look at the options that are before you, but dear God, do your homework before jumping to another company. Do your homework. There's so many companies in significant trouble here. And so got a lot of rough water to go through as an industry, but this is a solid industry. The underpinnings are very much there. So stay in the business for those of you who are serious. Those that are not, wish you well in your next career. Probably the best way to say it. We'll wrap it up with that. Thanks so much for everyone being here. Appreciate you as listeners. Thank you so much. Special thank you goes out to our sponsors, Byte Software, Finastra, Lending Homepage, True, Angel AI, Candid, CRM, Mortgage Bankers Association of America, Lenders One, Mortgage Collaborative, Mobility, MMI, Modix, and Knowledge Group. Thank you all for being here. Have a great week. Look forward to seeing you back here next week.
You've been listening to Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lickin of Transformational Mortgage Solutions. Join us next week, and thanks for listening.